Chapter 9. Alcohol and the Alchemy of Spirit. The ecstatic and orgiastic, visionary and boundary-dissolving experiences, the central mysteries of the mushroom religion, were the very factors in the human situation acting to keep our ancestors human. The commonality of feeling generated by the mushroom held the community together. The divine inspiring power of the mushroom spoke through the bards and singers. The indwelling spirit of the mushroom moved the hand that carved bone and painted stone. Such things were commonplace of the Edenic world of the goddess. Life was lived, not as we have chosen to imagine it, on the edge of mute bestiality, but rather close to a dimension of spontaneous magical and linguistic expression that now shines only briefly in each of us at the pinnacle of experimental intoxication, but that then was the empowered and enveloping reality, the presence of the great goddess. Nostalgia for Paradise. History is the story of our unfocused agony over the loss of this perfect human world, and then of our forgetting it altogether, denying it, and in so doing, denying a part of ourselves. It is a story of relationships, quasi-symbiotic compacts, with plants that were made and broken. The consequence of not seeing ourselves as a part of the green engine of vegetable nature is the alienation and despair that surrounds us and threatens to make the future unbearable. It took many centuries for the flame of Eleusis to gutter into extinction, for the partnership, mother-goddess view of community and society to fade. Then came many centuries more of nostalgia for paradise and its rivers of heavenly soma, a nostalgia that took new and varied forms as humans sought to satisfy the innate yearning for intoxication. All the natural narcotics, stimulants, relaxants, and hallucinogens known to the modern botanist and pharmacologist were discovered by primitive man and have been in use from time immemorial. One of the first things that Homo sapiens did with his newly developed rationality and self-consciousness was to set them to work to find out a way to bypass analytical thinking and to transcend, or in extreme cases, temporarily obliterate, the isolating awareness of the self. Trying all things that grew in the field or forest, they held fast to that which, in this context, seemed good. Everything, that is to say, that would change the quality of consciousness, would make it different, no matter how, from everyday feeling, perceiving, and thinking. Over the next few chapters, we will examine these substitutes for the original mushroom intoxicant of prehistory. Unfortunately, our survey will only serve to underscore how far we have fallen from the original dynamic equilibrium of the partnership paradise. Alcohol and honey. The great plant-drug complex that spans this cultural divide is alcohol. Alcohol has its roots in the deepest stratum of archaic cultural activities. Ancient civilizations of the Near East were preoccupied with beer-making. Very early in the development of human culture, if not long before, the intoxicating effects of fermented honey and fruit juices must have been noticed. Honey is a magical substance, a medicinal substance in all traditional cultures. As we have seen, it has been used to preserve both human bodies and mushrooms. Mead, or fermented honey, seems to have been the recreational drug of the Indo-European tribes. This was a cultural trait they share with the mushroom-using pastoralists of the ancient Near East. One of the most astonishing murals unearthed at Catal Hayuk apparently depicts the life cycle and metamorphosis of honeybees. The belief widely held in the classical world that bees were generated from the carcasses of cattle makes more sense if seen as an effort to connect bees as a source of honey and mead, the supplanting intoxicant, with cattle in the older mushroom cult. It may be that mead cults and mushroom cults that used honey as a preservative developed in close association with each other. Honey is closely connected to the great goddess rites of the archaic Minoan civilization and is a prominent motif in the myths surrounding Dionysus. Dionysus was said by the Roman poet Ovid to have invented honey, and the sacred ground on which the Maenads, his handmaidens, performed their ritual dance, was said to have flowed with milk, wine, and the nectar of bees. It was also said that honey dripped from the thyrso staffs that Maenads carried. Kerenyi, speaking of the honey offerings in Minoan religion, observes, "The honey offerings given to the mistress of the labyrinth carries the style of a much earlier period, that stage in which Minoan culture was still in contact with an age of honey." Each intoxicant, each effort to recapture the symbiotic balance of the human-mushroom relationship in the lost African Eden, is a paler, more distorted image of the original mystery than the last. The devolution of sacramental elements in the religion of the ancient Near East must have led from mushrooms, through fermented honey and juices, to the emergence of the grape as the favored wine plant. Over time, and often within the same cultures, fermented cereals and grains were manipulated experimentally to produce early types of beer. Wine and woman. Fruits rich in seeds, such as pomegranates and figs, appear from the earliest times as symbols of fecundity. The vine and its juice has a long history of religious significance. Deified like the Zoroastrian Heoma and Vedic Soma, its powers of exhilaration and intoxication were thought to be manifestations of divine possession. In the group of sacraments or mysteries that we shall examine, the vine symbolizes especially the fruitfulness of woman, and its juice, mostly unfermented, is drunk ceremonially in order to promote the fertility of the womb. Wine played a central part in later Greek culture, so much so that in classical times, the disturbing figure of ecstatic Dionysus was converted into the hairy-footed and lascivious wine god Bacchus, the lord of orgy and now drunken revelry, carried on in the traditional dominator style. The fermentation of grains and fruits must have been generally known and can claim no discoverer or point of origin. Greek wines have always been somewhat puzzling to scholars. Their alcohol content could not have exceeded 14%, since when a fermentation process reaches this concentration, further formation of alcohol is inhibited. Yet Greek wines are sometimes described as requiring many dilutions before they could be drunk with comfort. This seems to suggest that Greek wines were more akin to extracts and tinctures of other plant essences than they were to wine as we know it today. This would have made them more chemically complex and therefore more intoxicating. The practice of adding resin to wine and grease to make retsina may well hark back to times when other plants, perhaps belladonna or datura, also went into wine. Alcohol is the first example of a disturbing phenomenon that we will meet again and again in our discussion of differences in ancient and modern approaches to drug use and drug technology. Human use of alcohol in the form of fermented grains, juices, and mead is extremely ancient. Distilled spirits, in contrast, were not known to the ancients, though Pliny mentions one Roman wine so powerful that it burned when poured onto a fire. And today it is distilled alcohol that is the chief culprit among the drugs labeled legal and recreational. Natural and synthetic drugs. Discussion of alcohol gives us our first opportunity to examine the distinction between natural and synthetic drugs, for though distilled alcohol waited for hundreds of years to be joined by a second example of a chemically refined intoxicant, it was the first highly concentrated and purified drug, the first synthetic drug. This distinction is very important for the argument to be made here. Alcoholism as a social and community problem appears to have been rare before the discovery of distillation. Just as heroin addiction was the malignant flower that sprang from the relatively benign habit of opium use, so distilled alcohol changed the sacred art of the brewer and the vintner into a profane economic engine for the consumption of human hopes. It is no accident that alcohol was the first intoxicant to undergo this transformation. Alcohol can be fermented out of many kinds of fruits, grains, and plants, and so has been more widely experimented with than obscure and localized sources of intoxication. Indeed, fermentation is a natural process that in many cases is difficult to avoid, and fermented alcohol can be produced in prodigious, and hence commercial, amounts. The toddy palms of Southeast Asia produce debatably drinkable alcohol straight from the tree. Birds, raccoons, horses, and even wasps and butterflies are aware of the fleeting virtues that attend eating fermented fruit. In wild habitats, most intoxications occur with the ingestion of fermented fruits, grains, or saps. Field teams have investigated dozens of cases from Sumatra to the Sudan, involving creatures from bumblebees to bull elephants. The results? In natural habitats, most animals seek alcohol-laden food for the smells, tastes, calories, or nutrients they provide. The intoxications are side effects, but not serious enough to deter future use. One sort of accidental intoxication occurs when tree sap is exposed to the proper temperature and ferments. The North American sapsuckers, a type of woodpecker, drill pit-like holes in trees that then fill with sap. The birds feed on the sap and insects attracted to the sap pits. They move on to other trees, literally leaving the doors open for the sap to ferment and intoxicate other animals before the tree heals over. The drinking of fermented sap has been held responsible for an array of abnormal behaviors observed in hummingbirds, squirrels, and unsuspecting sapsuckers. Alcohol can be distilled by using heat to vaporize it and separate it from its source, unlike alkaloids and indoles, which must somehow be extracted using solvents and then concentrated. This fact, that a simple water-cooled condenser can capture the vapor of alcohol and return it to liquid form, made it possible for alcohol to be the first intoxicant to be chemically isolated. The quality of being recaptured from its vaporous state is what gave rise to the practice of referring to distilled alcohol as spirits. The first reference that we have to what might be a distilled form of alcohol occurs in the 4th century AD writings of the Chinese alchemist Ko Hung. In discussing recipes for the preparation of cinnabar, Ko Hung comments, "They are like wine that has been fermented once. It cannot be compared with a pure, clear wine that has been fermented 9 times. This statement seems to imply the knowledge of methods for the preparation of very strong, clear alcohols, perhaps by the capture of alcohol vapor in wool from which could be wrung a relatively pure liquid alcohol. Alchemy and alcohol. In the West, the discovery of distilled alcohol is alternately credited to the alchemist Raymond Lully, about whom very little is known with certainty, or to his peer and companion in alchemical exploits, Arnoldus de Villanova. Lully's search for the true elixir led him to the preparation of aqua vini, the first brandy. According to Matheson, Lully was so awed by the wonders of aqua vini that he thought its discovery must surely herald the end of the world. True to his alchemical roots, Lully made his universal panacea by fermenting wine in a double boiler of horse dung for 20 days before distilling it with a crude cold water condenser. Lully did not hide his discovery. On the contrary, he invited others to make the elixir for themselves and hailed the product offered by Villanova as comparable to his own. Of alcohol, he wrote, "The taste of it exceedeth all other tastes, and the smell all other smells. It is," he says, "of marvelous use and commodity a little before the joining in battle to encourage the soldiers' minds." These discoveries of the intoxicating chemical agent lying behind the fermentation of fruit juices, honey, and grains were made both in China and in Europe by alchemists. Alchemy was a slowly evolving, loosely knit, and not mutually exclusive group of Gnostic and Hermetic theories concerning human origins and the dichotomy of spirit and matter. Its roots reached back deep into time to at least dynastic Egypt, and the slow accumulation of jealously guarded secrets of processes for dyeing fabric, gilding metals, and mummifying bodies. Upon those ancient foundations had risen an edifice of pre-Socratic, Pythagorean, and Hermetic philosophical ideas, which ultimately came to revolve around the notion of the alchemical work as the task of somehow gathering into a unity and thereby rescuing the divine light that had been scattered through an alien and unfriendly universe by the fall of Adam. The natural world had come to be seen by late Roman times as a demonic and imprisoning shell. This was the spiritual legacy of the destruction of the partnership model of self and society and its replacement with the dominator model. The nostalgia for the Gaian Earth Mother was suppressed, but could not, cannot, be ignored. Hence it reemerged in time in a clandestine form, as the alchemical theme of the Magma Mater, the mysterious mother matrix of the world, somehow everywhere, invisible yet potentially condensable into a visible manifestation of the universal panacea residing in nature. In such an atmosphere of feverish and ontologically naive speculation, alchemy was able to thrive. Categories concerning self and matter, subject and object, were not yet fixed by the conventions introduced by phonetic alphabet and later exaggerated by print. It was not entirely clear to the alchemical investigators what about their labors was fancy, fact, or expectation. It is ironic that this was the context for the discovery of a powerful mind-altering drug. That the spirit and alcohol, sensed and enjoyed in beer and wine brewed through the ages, became in the alchemical laboratories a demon, an elemental and fiery quintessence. And like those other quintessences that would follow it into existence, morphine and cocaine, the quintessence of the grape once passed through the furnace and the retorts of the alchemist had become deprived of its natural soul. That absence made it no longer a carrier of the vitality of the earth, no longer an echo of the lost paradise of prehistory, but rather something raw, untamed, and ultimately set against the human grain. Alcohol as scourge. No other drug has had such a prolonged detrimental effect on human beings. the struggle to produce, control, and tax alcohol, and to absorb its social consequences, is a significant part of the story of the evolution of the mercantile empires of the 18th and 19th centuries. Alcohol and slavery often went hand in hand across the economic landscape. In many cases, alcohol literally was slavery, as the triangular trade of slaves, sugar and rum, and other practices of European civilization spread over the earth, subjugating other cultures. Sugar and the alcohol that could be made from it became a European obsession that severely distorted the demographics of tropical regions. For example, in the Dutch East Indies, now Indonesia, colonial policy paid women to produce as many children as possible in order to provide workers for the labor-intensive cultivation of sugar. The modern legacy of this policy is that Java, formerly the center of the Dutch East Indies, is today the most overpopulated large island in the world. Most of the sugar ended up as distilled alcohol, and what was not exported to Europe was consumed by the local population. A besotted underclass was a permanent fixture of mercantile society, whether in the home countries or the colonies. And what of the psychology of alcoholism and alcohol use? Is there a gestalt of alcohol, and if there is, then what are its characteristics? I have implied that alcohol is the dominator drug par excellence. Alcohol has the effect of being libidinally stimulating at moderate doses, at the same time that the ego feels empowered and social boundaries are felt to lose some of their restraining power. Often these feelings are accompanied by a sense of verbal facility, ordinarily out of reach. The difficulty with all of this is that research findings suggest these fleeting effects are usually followed by a narrowing of awareness, a diminishing of ability to respond to social cues, and an infantile regression into loss of sexual performance, loss of general motor control, and consequent loss of self-esteem. Moderation in drinking seems the obvious course, yet alcoholism is a major and unremitting problem throughout global society. I believe that the alcohol abuse syndrome is symptomatic of the state of disequilibrium and tension existing between men and women and between the individual and society. Alcoholism is a condition of ego obsession and inability to resist the drive toward immediate gratification. The social domain in which the repression of women and the feminine is most graphically and brutally realized is that of the drunken episode or lifestyle. The darkest expressions of the terror and the anxiety engendered by severance from the maternal matrix have traditionally been acted out there. Wife beating without alcohol is like a circus without lions. Alcohol and the feminine. The suppression of the feminine has been associated with the use of alcohol since very early times. One manifestation was the restriction of alcohol use to men. According to Lewin, women in ancient Rome were not allowed to drink wine. When Ignatius Maecenas's wife drank wine from a barrel, he beat her to death. He was later acquitted. Pompilio Faunus had his wife whipped to death because she had drunk his wine. And yet another Roman woman of the gentry was condemned to die of hunger merely because she had opened the cupboard wherein were kept the keys to the wine cellar. Dominator-style hatred of women, general sexual ambivalence and anxiety, and alcohol culture conspire to create the peculiarly neurotic approach to sexuality that characterizes European civilization. Gone are the boundary-dissolving hallucinogenic orgies that diminish the ego of the individual and reasserted the values of the extended family and the tribe. The dominator response to the need to release sexual tension in the ambience of alcohol is the dance hall, the bordello, and the institutionalized expansion of a new underclass, that of the fallen woman. The prostitute is a convenience for the dominator style with its fear and disgust of women. Alcohol and its social institutions create the social space in which this fascination and disgust can be acted out without responsibility. This is a difficult subject to address. Alcohol is used by millions of people, both men and women, and I will make no friends by taking the position that alcohol culture is not politically correct. Yet how can we explain the legal toleration for alcohol, the most destructive of all intoxicants, and the almost frenzied efforts to repress nearly all other drugs? Could it not be that we are willing to pay the terrible toll that alcohol extracts because it is allowing us to continue the repressive dominator style that keeps us all infantile and irresponsible participants in a dominator world characterized by the marketing of ungratified sexual fantasy? Sexual stereotypes and alcohol. If you find this difficult to believe, then think about the extent to which images of sexual desirability in our society are associated with images of sophisticated use of alcohol. How many women have their first sexual experiences in an atmosphere of alcohol use that ensures that these crucial experiences take place entirely on dominator terms? The strongest argument for the legalization of any drug is that society has been able to survive the legalization of alcohol. If we can tolerate the legal use of alcohol, what drug cannot be absorbed in the structure of society? We can almost see toleration of alcohol as the distinguishing feature of Western culture. This tolerance is related not only to a dominator approach to sexual politics, but also to, for example, a reliance on sugar and red meat, which are complementary to an alcohol lifestyle. In spite of natural food fads and a rise in dietary awareness, the typical American adult diet continues to be one of sugar, meat, and alcohol. This burnout diet is neither healthy nor ecologically sound. It promotes heart disease, abuse of the land, and toxic addiction and intoxication. It exemplifies, in short, everything that is wrong with us, everything that we have been left with as a result of an unhindered millennium of practicing the tenets of dominator culture. We have achieved the triumphs of the dominator style, triumphs of high technology and scientific method, largely through a suppression of the more untidy, emotional, and merely felt aspects of our existence. Alcohol has always been there when we needed to call upon it to propel us further down this same path. Alcohol helps nerve a man for battle, helps nerve men and women for love, and keeps an authentic perspective on self and world forever at bay. It is unsettling to realize that the delicately maintained web of diplomatic agreements and treaties standing between us and nuclear Armageddon was fabricated in the atmosphere of misguided sentimentality and blustering bravado that is typical of alcoholic personalities everywhere.